I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us this Friday. American troops are coming home from Syria. That message came from a U.S. military spokesman today. Without giving details, he said the withdrawal has begun. The Pentagon says about 2,000 American troops are fighting in Syria. It could take months for the pullout to be completed, but today's announcement makes sense in light of these words from the commander-in-chief on December 19th.
I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up. And we have won against ISIS. We've beaten them, and we've beaten them badly. We've taken back the land, and now it's time for our troops to come back home.
That's President Trump speaking in a video from the White House less than a week before Christmas, declaring victory over ISIS. Since then, there have been contradictory statements from administration officials at the highest level. Just one example, yesterday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the fight against ISIS continues and that America won't stop until ISIS is defeated and Iran driven out of Syria.
President Trump has made the decision to bring our troops home from Syria. We always do. And now is the time. But this isn't a change of mission. We remain committed to the complete dismantling of ISIS, the ISIS threat, and the ongoing fight against radical Islamism in all of its forms.
Mia Bloom, professor at Georgia State University, you've written several books on terrorism and violent extremism. What do you make of all these contradicting statements? Is ISIS defeated?
ISIS has territorially lost about 98% of what it held in 2014 and 2015. So that's definitely a positive. The last fighting that we saw was around Hajin, in which the U.S. was able to capture Hajin on the Euphrates. But the response from ISIS was to claim the December 2018 attack at the Strasbourg Christmas market. So while ISIS might be defeated in the region, this has inadvertently created incentives for ISIS to flex its muscles in other parts of the world. And at the same time, about 6,000 or 7,000 of those ISIS fighters that were in Syria have moved to other places in the region. So it's just shifted the focus of potential problems.
Right, that Christmas market in Strasbourg in France. Let me bring Colin Clark into the conversation here. He's with the security consulting firm, the Soufan Group. Colin, you specialize in terrorist financial networks. What is ISIS's financial situation right now?
Well, at one point it was accurate to call ISIS the richest terrorist group in the world. But I think, you know, media and even those of us terrorism scholars tend to focus too much on the group's credits. That is the money that the group has coming in. We don't focus enough on the group's debits. So even while the group is under siege and, as Mia pointed out, has lost approximately 99% of its territory, what that means to me is that it's got less money that it needs to spend on infrastructure and on governance. And so it has more than enough for a quote-unquote rainy day fund to wage a low-level insurgency in and around parts of Syria and Iraq for the better part of the next decade.
Yeah, I mean, reporting in the Washington Post suggests that maybe ISIS has access to billions in cash. Is that accurate?
The numbers are really tough to pinpoint. Billions might be overstating it, but even if it's hundreds of millions, I've seen the number 400 million, that's a lot of money for a group that tends to operate on a shoestring. It's way more money than any insurgent group would need.
All right, let's put a pin in the finances. We'll come back to that. Mia, the Trump administration is saying that it's pulling out of Syria, but that it will continue to work to defeat ISIS there. Can the U.S. do both and do them both effectively?
It's a challenge because I don't think that Erdogan in Turkey is a particularly reliable ally, although he states that, you know, he won't attack. The only thing that has prevented Turkey from attacking the Kurds, and the Kurds have been one of our most reliable allies in the region in terms of fighting ISIS, has been the presence of U.S. troops. And so I think that it's very difficult to pull out and continue to protect the Kurds. And we've kind of screwed over the Kurds in the past. We've made promises to the Kurdish communities for, you know, 25 years for protection. And when push comes to shove, we've left them holding the bag.
I would echo Mia's point. It's not only a matter of will for the Turks fighting against the Kurds or fighting against the Islamic State, which is very much in question as the Kurds tend to be Erdogan's primary target. It's also a matter of capability. You know, so fighting a two-front war is something that, even the Turkish military, which is highly regarded, there are questions about the ability to do that. And that says nothing of ISIS networks that stretch across the border into Turkey itself, sleeper cells, and other militants that look to take advantage of Turkey's communication infrastructure, financial networks.
Speaking, I would add one more thing.
Go ahead, Mia.
What Colin was saying, sorry, is that, you know, we know, for example, the State Department Special Representative for Syria, James Jeffrey, has said one of our policy goals is the departure of all Iranian military and proxy forces from Syria. But if we pull out, we are creating a power vacuum in the region that the Iranians and the Russians are most likely going to fill. So I think it runs counter to U.S. national interests if one of the major interests is to contain Iranian power.
Picking up on the sleeper cell thing, Mia, in the absence of territory in Iraq and Syria, what is your sense of ISIS recruitment in places like Europe and the U.S. right now?
Well, it's unclear as to whether the fighters who were in Syria are more dangerous than the ones who never went and might have been disillusioned. So I think there is definitely always going to be the threat of the so-called lone actor or people who are inspired by ISIS. But I think it's very important to your listeners to disaggregate and to differentiate between those plots that are directly sponsored and orchestrated by ISIS versus those that might just be inspired. The inspired plots are going to be impossible to prevent because any idiot can just say, I'm with ISIS, and the media tends to give ISIS credit for the attack, when in fact that might not actually be the case.
But in terms of actual ISIS kind of organized plots and stuff, I mean, Colin, how portable are the finances of ISIS right now? Because al-Qaeda was able to stage 9/11 for under $500,000.
Yeah, well, we've learned a lot of lessons, you know, in the counter-threat finance realm since 9/11. I actually wrote a book called Terrorism, Inc. in 2015, looking at a lot of the countermeasures put in place. We've made it incredibly difficult for terrorists and insurgents to use the licit financial system. We have seen some examples of the Islamic State sending money to its affiliates abroad. We saw some money being used to fund the siege of Marawi in the Philippines. Will we see more of that? Most likely. But it's very difficult to use the licit financial system now because of all the rules that have been put in place since 9/11.
Right, but many of these attacks that are going to happen abroad are not particularly expensive to carry out. It really doesn't take a lot of money to ram a truck into a group of people. And so that ultimately is the greatest danger, is that regardless of what ISIS finances are in the future, that people who are going to be inspired to do something horrible in the name of ISIS can do so at very low cost.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And in fact, Magnus Ransdorp wrote a piece for CTC Sentinel called Microfinancing the Caliphate, where he talked about various ways in which aspiring militants raised funds and very small amounts of money through things like fraud, various types of insurance schemes. So scraping together a few thousand dollars, especially if you're not worried about ruining your credit, is not very difficult to do.
I've been speaking with Colin Clark with the Sufan Group, where he specializes in terrorist financial networks, and with Mia Bloom, a professor at Georgia State University who studies terrorism and violent extremism. Mia, Colin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.